This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. Today, we talk about challenges to democracy. Later, we air an edited version of my interview with investigative journalist Greg Pallast about his book and movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. He says the GOP and its billionaire funders have been stealing the votes of millions of Americans. But first, we talk with political analyst, author, and radio host Wilmer Leon about his collection of essays spanning part of the Bush era and both terms of the Obama administration. Essays that examine four related themes: the challenge to democracy, the role of the U.S. media in shaping the nation's political persona, the geopolitics of U.S. war-making, and the everlasting conundrum of race in the United States. The collection is entitled Politics and Other Perspective, Commentary and Analysis on Race, War, Ethics, and the American Political Landscape in the Age of Obama. Why talk about the age of Obama in the age of Trump? Well, Wilmer Leon says that if we are to understand the moment we're in, we must look to the past to discover how we got here. He says we've fallen into a political abyss, pushed not only by the reactionary politics of the GOP, with its Tea Party and Freedom Caucus and now Trumpist base, but also by the inability of the Democratic Party and the Obama administration to articulate an effective counter-narrative. Wilmer Leon is the host of the radio show Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon on Sirius XM. He's a nationally syndicated columnist. Well, Wilmer Leon, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, this collection of essays, Politics and Other Perspectives, spans more than 10 years, roughly between about 2005 or 6 and 2016. I believe that is probably the last one. They span four related issues, you say, and those are the challenge to and defense of democracy. Second is the role of the U.S. media in shaping the nation's political persona, and I'm quoting you here. The third is the geopolitics of U.S. war-making in the 21st century. And fourth, the everlasting conundrum of race in the U.S. So tell us, how are these four issues related?
Well, it would have to be kind of more specific per issue, but generally what we have found over time, if we look at the invasion of Iraq, for example, that was a very unethical, if not illegal, move by the Bush administration. It took us into war. Race or anti-Islamic rhetoric was used as one of the mechanisms of selling that fake war. And it definitely had an impact then, and I believe we are still feeling that impact on the geopolitical landscape. So we could pick different issues. They aren't always related in that manner, but I think the Iraq War and how we got into it, how it was sold, and how we continue to find ourselves engrossed in it is an example of how those things come together in American politics.
And, of course, the media played a great role in constructing that invasion.
Absolutely. And what I find very ironic and pathetic is there were so many voices. With my being a radio talk show host, I had a number of people on my program before George Bush launched that invasion, while it was being engaged in, and then once the war actually started with boots on the ground, saying time and time and time again, these are lies, these are lies, these are lies. And it really just fell upon deaf ears for far too long.
Now, I found very interesting in your book how you really begin kind of at the beginning with the U.S. Constitution. You say that a lack of ethical compass has contorted American democracy from its founding. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, let me first, to get to that, explain why I start with the Constitution. One of the things that I try to do is I try to tie the current events into their broader historical context. one of the big problems that I believe we have with a lot of the analysis that we find ourselves listening to or reading is that people have a tendency to think that the issues that we are currently engaged in just sprung up out of the ground whole cloth, that things happen in a vacuum, and failing to understand that there's a much greater or broader historical context that we must try to place these events in if we really want to understand what's going on. I mean, that goes to the adage, if you don't understand your history, then you're doomed to repeat it. So that's really the nature of my approach to analysis and to the political dialogue. So now, with my having said that, now I forgot what your question was.
Yeah, sure. Well, what you say is the lack of an ethical compass. And actually, I'm going to... go ahead with that.
Well, yeah, we read these incredibly powerful ideals, whether we're reading the Declaration of Independence or whether we're reading the U.S. Constitution. Those documents are incredibly populist. They are incredibly, you know, focused on the best interest and the will of the people. And what we find all too often as we drill down into the motivations behind historical events, particularly of very, very recent memory, is we find now this neoliberal bent. We find that it's really the pursuit of the interest of corporate elites that are controlling the direction and the policy that we find ourselves engaged in. I mean, we can look at today or yesterday, it was announced Donald Trump wants to privatize the FAA. Now, you know, they want to privatize education. They want to privatize the Federal Aviation Administration. They want to privatize warfare with the development of companies like Blackwater and these private military entities that are engaging in our battle. So what we find now, as President Eisenhower warned us in 1960, in his farewell address about the military-industrial complex, the confluence of interests between militarists, legislators, and corporatists in this country. So we've really moved away very far afield from the ideals that are stated in the founding documents of our country. And we now find that it's corporate interests that are being served, and issues such as racism, xenophobia, anti-Muslim rhetoric are being used as wedge issues or wedge devices as a way to convince the public that the corporate interests are the ones that really need to be served.
And, of course, for so many decades, the government has been demonized at the same time that the government was being taken over by these corporations.
And that's a very good point, and I think that gets to some of, you know, people are talking about Donald Trump as being a populist, and what you find, there are different types of populism depending upon which side of the equation that you're on. Of course, populism basically being a politics that is focused on the best interest of the people, but in doing that, there is an entity that tends to get demonized. So on the Donald Trump side of the equation, or on the libertarian side of the equation, the alt-right side of the equation, it's government that is being attacked as being the evil entity that is not working in the best interest of the people. On the Democratic side, then tends to be the private sector that is demonized as not working in the best interests of the people. Again, so Donald Trump wants to privatize. And Trump is an interesting example because not only does he deal in populism, he also deals in a type of nationalist populism. But he rails against the government, and through Steve Bannon, his guru, his alter ego. You know, Steve Bannon wants to deconstruct the administrative state. So he's attacking the government interests, but then wants to privatize everything so that capitalism can flourish. So the demon depends on which side of the equation you're on in terms of your populism.
Yeah, and I guess my point was that the more that government is taken over by private interests, the less it serves the interests of the people and the more they blame the government.
You're absolutely right. And that is because of how the media, now with consolidation of the media, and the media becoming more and more of a corporate entity serving the corporate interests, and we've gotten where we're getting to a consolidation of the media, those issues aren't being clearly articulated and explained to the American people. And so they then fall victim to this incredible rhetoric that the Steve Bannons and the Donald Trumps and the so-called progressive side of the argument promote as well.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Wilmer Leon about his book, Politics and Other Perspective, Commentary and Analysis on Race, War, Ethics, and the American Political Landscape in the Age of Obama. Now, why the Age of Obama?
Well, a majority of these op-eds were written either right before the election of President Obama. The majority of them, there are 80 of them in the book, plus the epilogue. The majority of them were written during the Obama administration. The epilogue, for the most part, was written early during the election of Donald Trump. But also, I think it's important to see that the Age of Obama is not only a chronological point in time, basically his two administrations, but the Age of Obama is also an ideological conflict. And the ideological conflict, and I see that, well, we could either look at it from a so-called progressive argument where a lot of people saw listening to President or listening to Senator Obama's campaign rhetoric, saw him and anticipated that he would be very, very progressive. African Americans, looking at his phenotype, figured that he would be a quote-unquote black president, only to find out that I believe the politics that he ran on were never really his politics, and he wound up promoting, fostering, and carrying out a lot more of the Bush administration policies and politics than the progressive politics that he ran on. There's a piece in the book, Barack Obama is not the first black president. He was the first president who happened to be black. And a lot of people in reading that title think that I am somehow attacking his quote-unquote blackness, his phenotype, which I am not. What I am discussing in that article is policy analysis, that a quote-unquote black president would have been an individual who came into office with an agenda and policy initiatives that were specifically designed to address the ills and speak to the issues within the African-American community. President Obama didn't do that, and he made no bones about it, saying, you know, I'm the president for everyone. That, in my opinion, from a policy perspective, is not a black president. It's a president who happens to be black.
You know, you do seem to go through an evolution in these essays because you kind of call out people like myself, actually, who very early on got disenchanted with Barack Obama when he chose Larry Summers and Tim Geithner to be his first appointments, the appointments from Wall Street. So, I mean, he wasn't so much the president of all the people as the president of a certain part of the corporate class.
Absolutely right. But I was focused in terms of what I just previously said. I was focused more on what he was saying as opposed to what he actually did. Because to your point, when you look at who his first appointments were, they were corporatists. They were bankers. One of the first pieces of legislation, a lot of people love to hail that the point that one of the first pieces of legislation that President Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. But I actually think the first executive order that he signed before Lilly Ledbetter was absolving the telecom companies of any legal responsibility for being complicit with the Bush administration in violating the warrantless wiretapping. A lot of people forget that right at the end of the of the Bush administration, as Obama was coming into office, a lot of people thought that AT&T and Verizon and some of the other large telecom companies were going to be brought into court and sued for being complicit in the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping. And the first thing that Obama did was absolve them of any legal liability for doing so. So he showed right off the top that he was a corporatist. And again, when you look at a lot of the policies that he either continued or developed throughout his own administration, a lot of the policies had to do with enhancing the surveillance state. He went hard after whistleblowers. There were a number of things that he did that were contrary to the yes, we can, si se puede, and change we can believe in, and the transparent government. A lot of that stuff never really came to fruition. And, you know, people then want to tell me, oh, I don't understand what he was up against, and the Republicans hated him, and blah, blah, blah. And I got all of that, and I understand all of that. But when I look at policy output, which is what politics is supposed to be all about, is policy output. In many regards, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, he was more George Bush than George Bush.
And in fact, I think a lot of us think that what he set up, I mean, I remember when he set these things up and I thought, okay, well, maybe he's not going to go too far, but what if we get somebody who's really an authoritarian leader into the presidency after him, which exactly is what has happened.
Yes.
So, but I wanted to go back to this too, because it's not all one way. I mean, Obama did do some progressive things, and more than mm-hmm. that, the fact that he was elected, he was our first black president, was something to celebrate. So I wonder if you could talk about the contradictions of this. You know, what about the Obama presidency was a step forward, and what about it brought about a backlash that now we are still dealing with, and why?
Well, the greatest accomplishment, in my opinion, is the symbolism. The fact that America actually voted for and elected the first African American to be president of the United States. The symbolic significance of that, in my opinion, can never be overstated. I have a 15-year-old son, and I am able to say to my son, that guy, skin tone like yours, hair texture like yours, phenotypically looks just like you. You can do anything. You can even be president of the United States. As I was told when I was 10, when I was 9, but of course then it was wink, wink, chuckle, chuckle. Now we know that that is possible. And again, in my opinion, the significance of that can never be overstated. With that, we received what Dr. King called white backlash, what Dr. Ronald Walters called the politics of resentment. And the racist elements within this country saw the election of Barack Obama as the culmination of their greatest fears, particularly as we now see with greater numbers of immigrants continuing to come into the country, the color of the country is turning. The browning of America is what many refer to it as. And this is frightening, just frightening a lot of white people in this country. So much so, as my dear friend Tom Porter would say, there are a lot of people that would much prefer to eat their racism than to sit down and enjoy a fine meal. And Donald Trump played to those sentiments like a professional, whether it was the hordes of Mexicans that we have to protect ourselves against and build a wall against, or whether it's these crazy Islamicists who want to stream over our borders and fly into our airports and blow up Americans. He never wasted an opportunity to fan the flames of hatred, xenophobia, and racism. And that is continuing to be one of the major wedge devices that, to a great degree, brought our government to a stalemate and bringing our Congress to its knees.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with political analyst Wilmer Leon about his collection of essays, Politics and Other Perspective. Yeah, and in this light, there are a number of essays that you write in the book that focus on the issue of how the media constructs race and how our country constructs race in terms of now we see in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement. You take up the killing of Sean Bell, you know, which was before the killing of Eric Garner and Trayvon Martin.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk about that trajectory within the context, even going way back to the beginning of the founding of our country. Could you put that in historical context and then bring it up to today? I hope that's not too tall an order.
Well, very simply, we have to first understand and admit race does not exist. Race is an artificial construct that was created in this country in the 1600s as a way of accomplishing a couple of things. One, to the so-called Christians who settled this country, they had to find a way to rationalize how they were going to enslave groups of people, first Native Americans, and then when that didn't work out, Africans that they brought to America. They had to figure out a way how they were going to rationalize that behavior. And so they created this construct of race that enabled them to define a group of people as less than human. So once you have dehumanized that group of people, you then don't have to treat them as your brother. All humans are created in the eyes of God. Well, if they're not human, then obviously they don't meet that criteria. And that has been used since the beginning of this country. I go back in a couple of the pieces and cite the Virginia slave codes of the 1600s. That was the first place that I saw the answer to the question, what happens to a child that is born from a relationship between a slaveholder and a slave? Well, the child takes the position of the mother. Can a master be convicted of murdering a slave? No, why not? Because no one in their right mind would destroy their own estate. That is where I first see we are defined or codified as being property. And so that mindset has been prevalent throughout this country's history. Whether it's Plessy v. Ferguson, whether it's Dred Scott, in Plessy v. Ferguson, a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect.
And even the Constitution, because you talk about the three-fifths of a man.
It's in the Constitution, the three-fifths compromise, the fugitive slave provision, and the fact that slavery was allowed to exist for 25 years after the Constitution, without the importation of slaves, was allowed to exist for 20 years, I guess, after the Constitution was ratified, even though the word slavery is not found in the Constitution. So we see throughout history, time and time and time again, that deference is always given to the sensibilities of white people. The government, whether it be legislatively, whether it be from the judiciary, those elements of the government always take into account the sentiments of white people. When you look at the famous Brown v. Board of Education case, and that is hailed as one of the landmark decisions of jurisprudence in this country as it relates to equality. But even in Brown v. Board of Education, which was Earl Warren's as Chief Justice, that was the first case that he had influence over when Eisenhower nominated him to the Supreme Court, the out was four words, with all deliberate speed. So once it was determined that separate but equal was not fair, was not equal, instead of setting a hard timetable and forcing the states to integrate, they gave the states the out with all deliberate speed. So we see time and time and time again, and this we fast forward to where we are now with the extrajudicial murders of unarmed African Americans by police in this country. That brings about the Black Lives Matter movement. But what happens to the Black Lives Matter movement? Media quickly picks up on the Blue Lives Matter, because somehow it gets misinterpreted that for African Americans to be pro us, we somehow have to be anti-white. For us to be against police killing, that somehow translates into we must be anti-police. And there could be nothing further from the truth. But that is how the narrative gets morphed from being a pro-life movement into being anti-life movement. And now what do we see with the Trump crime bill that he's trying to push through Congress? They're now looking to make it a felony to resist arrest. So what could happen very simply is you get pulled over for a traffic stop. The police officer asks you to get out of the car. You, in getting out of the car, inadvertently bump the police officer. Somehow the police officer either gets touched by you or happens to fall down. That police officer then can take that instance, turn that into resisting arrest, and your traffic stop has just turned into a 2-year to 10-year federal prison sentence.
Well, and also a new GOP bill would make it impossible, virtually impossible, to sue the police. That's something.
That's exactly part of what I'm talking. That's the same thing I'm talking. Yes.
That's the same bill?
Make it impossible to sue the police for assault.
It's very interesting because the Black Lives Matter movement was really gaining strength under Obama. What does the election of Donald Trump and the control of the three branches of government by the Republicans mean for Black Lives Matter and other mass movements of its kind?
Well, I'd have to take a step back and say that I believe, and some may scream and yell it and throw darts at me for saying this, that the Black Lives Matter movement got compromised long before Donald Trump. I believe it was the money of George Soros that got injected into the Black Lives Matter movement that derailed it ideologically and compromised it incredibly. George Soros, from what I have read and been told by some who put a lot of money behind the Black Lives Matter movement, and because the movement had not developed into a real movement with a real defined organizational structure, with a clearly defined agenda with objectives and metrics to be able to determine success and failure, that a lot of the money that went into the movement wound up co-opting it, because he who pays the piper calls the tune. So it has become, I believe, more difficult for the Black Lives Matter movement to stay true to its grassroots foundings because of the money that has been injected into the movement, and people now are paying more attention to the benefactor than they are to the people that are supposed to benefit. And the other problem that I saw with Black Lives Matter was it, to a great degree, was a youth-centered movement, and they really still don't understand the dynamics of organizing, and they don't understand the politics of organizing, and they don't understand the benefit of organizing. And so there became a generational rift between the young people that were running it and the elders with the experience from the civil rights movement, from SNCC, from CORE, from other successful civil rights era entities who wanted to explain to them, look, this is how you organize at the grassroots level. here are the landmines that you need to pay attention to. And it was, to a certain degree, look, old people, we don't need you anymore. You all aren't on social media. You all aren't on Facebook. You're not communicating like we're communicating. Don't tell us how to run this thing. And to me, that then has meant they have not been able, or they have failed to take advantage of the history learned from those that have come before them.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because that brings up another essay in a way, which is the Democrats' problem with democracy. It's about a different thing, but I think it goes to the heart of it. I mean, we all know George Soros is, you know, a contributor to the Democratic Party and Democratic causes, and he has his, I forget what it's called, Democracy Institute or something like that. And yet the Democrats were criticized by many, including many in the Bernie Sanders camp, of not being democratic, and that they paved the way in some way for Trump to become elected. So I wonder if you could bring that in here. Do you think there's a problem that the Democrats have with democracy? And then how are people, not just Black Lives Matter, but all the other resistance groups that have sprung up, what do they need to do to bring greater democracy at this time?
They need to really listen to the grassroots progressive voices that are crying out for representation, instead of having those who are in power and have been in power, such as the Nancy Pelosi's and the Hillary Clintons. It's time for some of these folks to relinquish power. And they have not created a bench. They don't have any young progressives that they have brought into the fold and have been mentoring and preparing to take the mantle of leadership as it becomes time for the older heads to go. What I go back to on this, I was watching a town hall meeting a couple months ago from California. Nancy Pelosi was heading this town hall, and a millennial stood up and started talking about the challenges of capitalism and why capitalism isn't really conducive to democracy. And Nancy Pelosi, and the kid was really demonstrating that he had done some reading. That he had actually read, you know, some fairly progressive political thinkers, and she just dismissed him out of hand. Well, democracy, capitalism is the system that we have in this economy, and that's all I got to say about that. Instead of listening to the guy and saying, you know what, young man, there are a number of things that you're speaking to that we need to flesh out and develop. Instead of encouraging the dialogue, she just shut it down as, oh, you know, this is just some ideological blabber, and let's move on. They totally ignored the Bernie Sanders movement. There are those who would say, and I think that there's some rationale for saying this, that progressives in this country would have been better off if Donald Trump had beaten Bernie Sanders, then Donald Trump beating Hillary Clinton. And the reason is Bernie Sanders had a movement behind him. Hillary Clinton had nothing.
Really?
So even if Bernie Sanders ran, if Bernie Sanders had won the Democratic nomination and lost to Donald Trump, the result of his losing would still have been a stronger grassroots organization, a real resistance in place, as opposed to Hillary Clinton coming on TV 2 weeks ago saying, I'm now with the resistance, blah, 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 blah. Well, Hillary, if you're part of the resistance, then the war is lost.
Wilmer Leon. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with political analyst Wilmer Leon about his collection of essays, Politics and Other Perspective, Commentary and Analysis on Race, War, Ethics, and the American Political Landscape in the Age of Obama. Before the break, Leon pointed to mistakes made by the Democratic Party in the last election that helped Trump win. I asked him to comment on the claim the Democrats have made that Russian hacking may have cost them the election.
It's not the Russians and the Kremlin that impacted the election. It's Kris Kobach from Kansas and the Republicans. And I don't hear hardly anybody in leadership in the Democratic Party talking about the cross-check program and how the Republicans in about 25 or 26 states successfully disenfranchised legally registered voters. That's how Donald Trump won Michigan. That's how Donald Trump won Arizona. That's how Donald Trump won North Carolina. That's how Donald Trump won Pennsylvania. Through knocking primarily African American, Hispanic, and Asian voters off of the voting rolls. Through the cross-check program. Greg Palast has done an incredible amount of research, an incredible amount of investigative journalism, an incredible amount of reporting, and documenting the impact that Kris Kobach's cross-check program had on the election. But the Democrats, particularly Hillary, would rather sit around and scream about Vladimir Putin, the Kremlin, and the Russians instead of Kris Kobach, cross-check, and the Republican Party. Donald Trump has put Kobach in charge of the commission that is supposed to research voter fraud in this country. So all that's going to do, you basically put the fox in charge of the hen house, so now there won't be a hen left because the fox is going to eat them all.
Exactly, and that is a well-placed reminder of what really happened in the election and what we need to do to fight against that happening again in 2018 and 2020.
Because here's what people need to... Now, I'm a political scientist. I'm a social scientist. I believe in data that supports positions taken. There is no such thing as vote fraud in this country, unless we're talking about what the Republicans did in the election. What I mean by vote fraud is people that I decide that I'm going to go to the polls and vote as you. That's not happening. I think the numbers are 0.00000, like 472% of votes in this country are cast illegally. Yes, people make mistakes. Yes, people who have moved from one house to another go to the wrong precinct and try to vote. Yes, there are dead people listed on the rolls because people die and the rolls don't get purged in any type of timely manner, but there aren't a bunch of zombies that are leaving the burial grounds, walking to the polls trying to vote. That's not happening. But that's the narrative that Republicans have used and the media has allowed them to promote so that people walk around here thinking that there are people trying to vote as someone else. It's just not happening.
And it's interesting, the latest revelations that, you know, say by The Intercept, that say that the Russians hacked into the voter registration rolls. When I saw that, I actually thought, well, voter registration problems happened in the Democratic primary. They were huge. 250,000 people were disenfranchised in Brooklyn alone, much less many other places around the country. So that would be another area to look at. And CrossCheck actually does work with voter registration, and maybe that should be something that people look at before the next elections.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you, Wilmer Leon, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is Politics and Other Perspective, commentary and analysis on race, war, ethics, and the American political landscape in the age of Obama. Thanks so much.
Francesca, thank you so much. And people can go to WilmerLeon.com. Go to WilmerLeon.com to get the book, or they can go to Amazon.
Wilmer Leon is the host of the radio show Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon on Sirius XM. He's also a nationally syndicated columnist. Next up, we dive in a little deeper into Kris Kobach's voter suppression system, CrossCheck. Last summer, I spoke with investigative reporter Greg Palast about his just-released movie based on his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. The film is an entertaining mix of documentary footage and cartoon imagery, connecting the dots between predatory capitalism and voter suppression to create what Palast calls an apartheid voting system in America. The movie takes a deep dive into the GOP's dark operation headed by Kris Kobach, CrossCheck, and the billionaires who finance it. After the film was released and after the election, Palast estimated some 7 million votes were effectively stolen from largely minority and young voters by CrossCheck. Kris Kobach is now heading the President's Commission on so-called voter fraud. What follows is an edited version of my interview with Palast, which I did in 2016. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview. Trump has been saying that this election is going to be rigged. Now, in the beginning, he didn't really specify what he meant, but more recently, he's been actually channeling the whole idea of voter fraud.
Yes.
This is something you really tackle. It's a central idea. Explain what voter fraud is, and more importantly, what the hysteria over voter fraud is.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump says the election's rigged, and he ought to know because his buddies are rigging it. And in particular, he has said that the way that they're rigging it, that the way the election's being rigged is by people voting multiple times. He says people are voting many, many times. People are voting multiple times. Well, if you vote more than once in election, yeah, that is a federal crime. So, Donald, where did you get the idea that people are voting many times? It's from his operatives. These Republican GOP operatives like Kris Kobach, who's the Secretary of State of Kansas. He's like Catherine Harris of 2016. And he has taken the voter rolls of 30 Republican states, put them together, and found the double voters lurking in the American electorate. And there are 7 million suspects on his list, 7 million people. And what they're doing is the GOP is systematically removing these people from the voter rolls. They don't know it. They don't realize that they're being thrown off the voter rolls because they've been accused of voting twice. They get no notice of this. But I investigated. I said, give me the list of these terrible double voters, and you'll see this in the film. This the one big story that keeps going through the film is my hunt for those who are creating these lists and who's behind them, etc. So they're creating these lists, and there are 7 million people on the suspect list. They wouldn't give it to me because they said, well, it's confidential because it's a criminal investigation. I said, you have 7 million suspects in a crime? Really? You want to give me some of those names? No. Have you arrested anyone? No. Why? It's hard to find them. I said, how is it hard to find people who vote twice? You got their addresses, and they walk into the voting booth. They just cuff them. The reason they don't arrest any of these suspects, is that they didn't commit the crime. Their only crime is voting while black or brown or Asian. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's a list. I finally got my hands on it, as you see in the film. This gives away nothing because there's so many stories in there. In The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I get my hands on 2 million of their suspect names. And we have run through the list. And first of all, we find out it's people like Maria Isabel Hernandez, who votes in Virginia, supposed to be the same exact voter as Maria Cristina Hernandez, who votes in Louisiana. Now, are these the same person with is she like Maria sneaking around and having a different middle name? Or is it the problem that it's just a common name? Well, it's not a common name for Republicans. So Maria Hernandez, Jesse Jackson, James Brown, David Lee, David Wong, you're getting the picture.
Yeah, in fact, you say as much as 20% voters of color in certain states, like, is it Ohio? Are actually on this list. I mean, if you purge 20% of the voters on the voter list, and if they tend to vote Democratic, Ohio's a swing state.
Exactly. Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona. These are the top swing states that are going to determine not only the presidency, but even more important, the United States Senate. These are the hottest Senate races, Ohio and North Carolina and Arizona, and the other states using this cross-check purge system of scrubbing the voters white, the voter rolls whiter than white. And so, yeah, you're up to, in some states, 1 in 5 minority voters. Throughout the 30 states, 1 in 8 Asian Americans. Why? Especially, and it's even worse in the Korean community. Now, why would they go after Asian Americans? They used to vote Republican. They switch. They vote as if they've turned black. And you see that in the film when they, there's this thing called voting Gangnam Style, and you got these Korean kids doing a hip hop, and then suddenly one of them turns into John Lewis because they're turning black as voters. And, you know, so the film is meant to expose this, and the book that goes with it are meant to expose this creepy thing of removing voters of color through this trick of saying, oh, James Brown literally voted 288 times in Georgia, or is it just a common name?
I asked Greg Palast about what happens when people show up to vote only to find that they've been purged from the voter rolls.
You have to understand, if you're black, you're going to get about 1 in 7 black people are going to be handed something called a provisional ballot, which doesn't get counted, doesn't have to be counted, because your name's on the voter roll. They don't like your ID, anything. They say, oh, don't worry, so you don't scream. They give you this thing called a provisional ballot. I call it a placebo ballot. For example, if your name's not on the voter roll and you fill out a placebo ballot, provisional ballot, you think you voted. But if you're not on the voter roll, you're not on the voter roll. They can't count your vote. But even if they took it, even if they killed your registration because they falsely accused you of voting another time, falsely accused you of being an alien. This is the trick that they use on Hispanics, right? They say, oh, well, on the deportation list, there's a guy named Jose Hernandez. You're Jose Hernandez. And you can't say, well, you know, it's el mismo nombre, it's the same name. No, that doesn't count. Sorry, you are Jose Hernandez. They know you're not that Jose Hernandez, but it's an excuse to knock off your vote. It's cheap, it's crappy, it's low, it's apartheid. But it's not the old type of redneck racism that kept black people from voting 50 years ago. This is new and sophisticated. These are billionaires funding programs which take away the votes of minorities or students or lower working class people. These are people that are hostile to the system. They got to get them off the voter roll. So they use all these tricks. And my job as a reporter for many years is to expose the tricks and the people and the fat cats who are funding this stuff and profiting from it.
Early voting is also under attack because African-American voters use early voting more than other voters. Palast accompanied some of those voters going out to vote early.
So, for example, there's a church, the Freedom Faith Missionary Baptist Church of Dayton. And I showed up. I just showed up, by the way. They're very kind. You see the woman say, would you like to join us for services? I say, sure. And it's great. You know, you get the great gospel music. And then they all, it's Souls to the Polls Day. This is, now I flash back to 2012. Souls to the Polls Day. I get in the church van with them and we go off to early voting in Ohio. And what happens? We get to Dayton. And now, on the day when white people vote, which is the Tuesday, which is what we call normal election day, black people don't get the day off, or they don't have wheels, so they have to go on the Sunday for early voting. On white voting day, there were 176 polling stations in the Montgomery area, in the Dayton-Montgomery County area. On the Souls to the Polls Day, the Republican state elections chief ordered that there be only one single polling station per city. So all of Cleveland had one polling station. All of Dayton had one polling station, and you can see in the film, I'm walking along this line, 80,000 people, almost all of them black folk, we're told to wait in line for a single polling station. The county elections chief was going crazy. He knew, and I said, why are they doing this? And he said, because they can challenge these votes. Dig this, they wait in line 5 hours and they don't get to vote. They were ordered not to let people vote, but to give them absentee ballots. Now, you understand, they're not absent. This is an official polling station. They've waited 5 hours. They get a number, and when their number is called, they get an absentee ballot. They fill out the application for an absentee ballot. They wait in another line, get an absentee ballot, fill that out, stick it in the envelope. They don't make them put a stamp on it because they're right there in the office. They just hand it in. Now, why would they do that? One, 5 hours hoping to discourage you. Second, making this a complicated process. And third, in the middle of the night, I drive in the film, I drive in the middle of the night to Professor Bob Fitrakis' house, a voting rights expert, and he said, my God, this is horrible because if you vote, it's in the machine, you vote. But if you hand in an absentee ballot, you're playing roulette because you have to fill out all these forms. Any stray mark on an absentee ballot, any stray mark on the form, you forgot your middle initial, you forgot that you registered with your middle initial, you're dead. You added junior when you registered, but you didn't sign it junior when you did the absentee ballot. Or you signed the junior and you didn't when you registered and you didn't remember. Or it says you have to add your driver's license. If you leave it blank because you don't have a driver's license, they disqualify your ballot. You're supposed to say no driver's license. But they don't tell you that. So it's all these tricks. And over a million absentee ballots. People mail in their ballots. Don't go postal. But they did this because they knew that this was the black voting day. So you have an apartheid voting system in America. It's all about being able to manipulate that vote. And that's why Karl Rove went crazy back in 2012. Because he said he called the Secretary of State. And I heard his entire statement that night. He was talking about the early voting. And he says, well, we're going to have to take a look at those early votes. Because he thought that they were going to challenge 200,000 black votes. Well, we busted it, and we went. When I did that report, Bob Fitrakis actually went to a federal court that morning and busted the scheme.
I asked Greg Palas to comment on the impact of the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act in 2013.
In 2013, the Supreme Court cut the guts out of the Voting Rights Act. And literally, within hours, not even days, within hours, Alabama and a bunch of other states changed their laws because they no longer were under federal scrutiny to prove that they're not discriminating against voters of color. So literally within hours, they started going back to the old Jim Crow laws. And for example, this whole system of hunting for double voters, removing them from the voter rolls called cross-check, that could have never spread until that Voting Rights Act was pulled out of the way. So cross-check suddenly started traveling around the country like a virus till it grew to 7 million suspects. Then all these new voter ID laws, I go to Alabama, and within literally 2 hours after the court decision came down, Alabama passed a law requiring that everyone have, if not a driver's license, a identification card from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And then, within another day, they closed almost every DMV in the 10 black belt counties. The 10 counties where most black people live in Alabama, they simply said, okay, you need to have a DMV certificate, and we're closing all the DMV offices. So this is one of the tricks. And then I go meet with Senator Hank Sanders, who was one of the original marchers with Martin Luther King. And one of the things that's great about America, here was a guy whose parents couldn't vote. He couldn't vote. King began his march for voting rights in Selma, Alabama. And by the time he arrived in Montgomery, we had the president backing the Voting Rights Act. So we end up with Sanders becoming a state senator. So Senator Sanders calls me up and said, Greg, I've been removed from the voter rolls, and I'm a state senator. And so he says, if they can do that to me, they can do it to anyone. So then we go back, and how do we overcome this? One of the things you could do, for example, if you are on this evil secret cross-check list of supposedly voting twice because your name happens to be David Washington, you can overcome it by registering again. Every state, you can register online now. And I tell people, please register online. They say, well, I've been registered. I've been voting 20 years. That's what they want you to think. Then you show up to vote and they go, your name's not on here. I say, why? I've been voting all these years. Sorry, Jack. You ain't voting because you've been on a list that you didn't know about. You've been accused of being a felon. You've been accused of being an alien. You've been accused of voting in another state already. And this, you know, and you don't know this, and it's all crazy, and you don't have any time to fix this. So what you do is you fix it before you get there. That's one thing, is to simply re-register. It defeats their franchising systems, disenfranchising system. By the way, you use the term disenfranchisement or vote suppression. But when someone steals your car, they don't suppress your car. They steal it. And the important thing is that you can take steps, but you have to also be part of a movement. And so if the billionaires create pressure through their money, we have to create pressure through our numbers. And that means everyone signs, everyone votes. And one thing I don't want people to do is be discouraged that it's difficult to vote, so I don't want to bother. Oh, I've got to check my registration now before I even go down to vote. I got to go online. Yes, you do. I got to bring other people. I got to fight for it. Well, sorry, you're going to fight for democracy.
Greg Palast, this has just been a terrific interview. The film is a terrific film. I urge everybody to go see it. And thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's always fun.
Greg Palast talking with me in the summer of 2016. That was an edited version of our conversation. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview. You'll also find a link to Palast's Rolling Stone article, The GOP Stealth War Against Voters. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.